Welcome back to KPCW's This Green Earth. We are broadcasting live from the Whole Foods Cafe today. I'm Nell Larson. This is Chris Cherniak.
Hello.
And with us this hour is Todd Miller, the director of Dinosaur 13, a film about unearthing the largest, most complete Tyrannosaurus Rex ever found. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So my first question for you is, how did you happen upon this story and this topic?
Well, I had actually read the book that the film's based on, which is called Rex Appeal, which was written by paleontologist Peter Larson. And I met Peter in the course of interviewing a lot of other paleontologists around the country. We had basically packed up our truck out of Brooklyn and went on the road, got out of the city, and packed some tents in the truck and went to museums and interviewed paleontologists. And Pete was last on our list. And I was reading the book while we were on the road trip, and I was just so enthralled. Words were just jumping off the screen. So I ended up, making an offer to option the book. And Hollywood had been really banging down his door for a long time.
Really?
He'd always turned them down. And we had a different approach, which was to just put everybody, that was involved in the story on camera. And he was open to that. And, 3 years later, here we are.
The film, at least when you read about it, is a little bit unlike your usual environmental documentary. I mean, this scene, it's like part drama and suspense, and there's a really strong storyline behind this story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, I guess, grabbed me was not only the characters, but also, the environment that they exist in. Being out in the Badlands of South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, it's just beautiful. So, for us, and I shoot as well as and edited the film, but my director of photography, Tom, and I, we just had a ball shooting vast open landscapes. Mm-hmm. Camping overnight underneath the stars, going on dinosaur digs. So it was just a real fun experience for us.
For first time producing or directing a film like this?
Yeah, a feature documentary, yeah.
Really?
I've been in the business a long time, more in the commercial and corporate world. So, quite frankly, we got a little sick of that. So this was,
sure.
This was our opportunity to, do something that we really wanted to do on our own terms. And luckily we stumbled on the book and, 3 years later, here we are.
So set the scene for us of this film. Tell us, this dinosaur was discovered, and then what happened?
So the dinosaur was discovered in 1990, and in the course of working on it, as you probably know, dinosaurs take a lot of time and preparation to get them ready. And the idea behind the discovery was they were going to put it in their museum, their local museum in Hill City, South Dakota. In the course of preparing the dinosaur was seized by the federal government, and that thrust the original discoverers and this institute into a custody dispute that lasted several years, which ultimately led to a criminal trial, which became the largest criminal trial in South Dakota's history and the most expensive. And then that led to 7 years, now we're at 1997, that led to an auction that happened with the dinosaur, and then the film kind of goes from there.
What?
So we really cover like the 10-year period after the discovery and the lives of the original discoverers.
What was the government's contention that it was their dinosaur in effect, right?
Yeah, so the main controversy, it touches on a lot of different things. There is some controversial aspects with fossil collecting as it relates to whether you're an academic that's funded through a university or through a museum versus the commercial aspect of it. Here in the United States, you can actually, on private lands, collect fossils, and then you're able to sell them. And that's a unique thing that only happens here in the United States. So we see things like dinosaur auctions happening here in the United States. We just had a couple in Manhattan in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm.
What a strange idea, a dinosaur auction in Manhattan.
Right, yeah. We actually
different
one
types
down.
Of T-Rexes in Manhattan, too.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it's always fun to see a T-Rex
Wall Street
going
T-Rex.
Down Fifth Avenue.
Right.
Yeah.
So the arc of the story here is like, who owns this at the end of the day? who's the ultimate owner of this.
Exactly. So it became a dispute in ownership. And there was four main people that sought ownership. There was the Black Hills Institute, which were the original discoverers. There was an Indian tribe, the Cheyenne River Sioux Indian tribe. There was the landowner himself, a man by the name of Morris Williams, who was a quarter Cheyenne River Sioux Indian. The dinosaur was actually found on trust land. So it went into, you know, a bunch of, as one of the characters in the film, Sioux, the name of the dinosaur, came out of a legal netherworld. And it's very much true. And then the fourth was the U.S. government.
Holy smokes. And no one's going to agree to, like, splitting it up.
No.
Taking a yeah. fifth of each. You know?
Yeah, that sounds like a parable of some
all.
Sort.
It's yeah. all or nothing, and that's what yeah. the film chronicles. Ultimately, somebody ends up getting it.
Exactly.
Won't give away the ending or so to that effect. 3.5 years to do this?
Yeah, from start to finish.
Start to finish? Is that what you kind of think about as a documentarian? Like, this is years in length, and so don't panic or freak out if, you know, it. 1 year and it follows another year. The documentarian has to have some patience.
Yeah, we were actually pretty much on schedule. I mean, we said in my pitch originally to option the book, I said this is going to be a long process. You guys are going to love us. You're going to hate us. It's mm-hmm. going to be, you know, very tough. And it turned out it was a great experience all around. So hopefully they don't hate us. But no, it was it definitely you really prepare for that sort
yeah.
of, you know, length with something like this. But it was really important to us. You know, we're trying to make films that do have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So it was just a question of just going out, getting the subjects on camera. And that was more of the, you know, obstacle for us was trying to get those people, particularly in the government side of things, comfortable with us and being on camera to tell their stories.
It's impressive that you were even, I think, able to get the government representatives to come on camera for a documentary.
Yeah, they were, you know, enough time had passed that there was a lot of guys that had retired. There were still some that were in government and still are. One of the main prosecutors in the criminal trial is now a state judge in South Dakota. So I talked at length with him over the years. So it was more like verifying facts. Unfortunately, he couldn't get on camera. But then we had some other people that were, you know, agents and the FBI and the IRS that were able to get on camera and National Park Service guys. So and they, you know, they wanted the story to be told. And so did we, you know, in a truthful manner. Mm-hmm. So now enough time had passed that we can make that happen.
We're speaking with Todd Miller, director of Dinosaur 13 documentary, entered here in the competition. We got a few more minutes.
I'm curious about the title. What's the significance of the 13, Dinosaur 13?
So when we were kids growing up, there was only 12 T-Rex specimens that had ever been found. So that was prior to 1990. So of those 12, less than 40% of the actual specimens have been found. So growing up, we really didn't even know what a T-Rex actually looked like. We didn't know the length of the tail exactly. We didn't know, you know, exactly what the arms looked like because we'd never found a complete arm before. So when Sue was found, she was the 13th T-Rex that was found. And she was, you know, by all accounts, in the field, they estimated anywhere from 80 to 90% complete. So this was far and away almost double what we knew and for the science of Tyrannosaurus rex. So that's where the title comes from.
And it sounds like it had some major implications for what we actually know about the T-Rex.
Absolutely. You know, things like dinosaur growth and behavior, dimorphism. There's so much that was to be learned from this individual specimen. And since that time, there's been over 40 now. So
okay, that's what I was curious. Since then, obviously more have been found. And
it's really exploded, not only with technology, but more people looking, you know, for them. One of the kind of fun facts that one of the guys told me was we can take everyone in the whole world and do nothing but dig dinosaurs for the rest of our lives, and maybe we'll, you know, find 1% of them. So
wow.
There's a lot of bones to be found out there, and they weather out. So, you know, we have to wait for, you know, changes in the in environment in order to for them to be exposed.
First film at Sundance?
Yes.
And pretty happy when you got accepted? What were you thinking? You're, you know, again, all right, I'll give it a shot, like the other director we spoke to. $100 or so. Let's give it a shot.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, Sundance was the pinnacle for me, and we were nobodies. So I'd always kind of, like, in the last few years, kind of thought Sundance was kind of had to know somebody or... And, I mean, having not only the film get in, but then premiere tonight on opening night was just like, you know, I'm speechless. It's just been, like, an unbelievable experience.
And tell us about tonight's premiere where?
Tonight's premiere is at the Eccles Theater at 9:30 p.m.
No kidding.
Fantastic. Are there still tickets available? Can our listeners come see the film?
I think so. Yeah, try.
Perfect. Try.
Yeah, try and come out. And if not, I know it's playing twice tomorrow and again on Saturday.
Okay, so there'll be other times, yes, other opportunities.
There'll be other times, other opportunities.
And of course, then it'll get picked up.
Yeah, I hope so.
We'll be seeing it on the History Channel or the Discovery Channel.
And
at
hopefully
some point.
We can get people to go out there and dig some more dinosaurs.
Perfect.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Todd Miller, the director of the film Dinosaur 13.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. Hey, let's take a little break for some underwriters. When we come back, we'll be speaking with the director of the documentary Marmato. That'll be Mark Grieco. It's a story about Colombian gold mining. It's This Green Earth, and we'll be back right after these words from our underwriter. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, wattsmart.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage services provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more, currently nearly 6 million pounds per year. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Eric Lee, attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo. As a Park City resident for 20 years, I'm proud to support KPCW. Jones Waldo provides legal services to residents of Summit County in many areas. 435-200-0085. JonesWaldo.com.
Welcome back to the Sundance special of This Green Earth, where we spend 2 hours every Sundance here at Whole Foods for their 5% day, where the Whole Foods donates 5% of their today's proceeds to KPCW. We thank them for that. And we, Nell and I, get the chance to speak to directors and producers and other talent associated with Sundance Film Festival. We've been doing this for 5 years. And this year is just as good, if not better, than the others. And this next film, this next story is really fascinating. It's a documentary called Marmato. Mark Grieco?
Grieco.
You know, you just told me,
come
like
on, Chris.
45 seconds ago, and I want to write that.
That's
Mark,
okay.
Grieco, the director.
And Mark is the director of the film Marmato. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So outline the film for our listeners. Yeah.
So this is a historic mining town in Colombia. It's been there for about 500 years. The Spanish found the indigenous mining the gold basically off surface. And so now they've been mining in kind of a traditional small-scale way for hundreds of years. But just starting in about 2006, a Canadian mining company arrived and started buying up mines. And their plan was basically to move the town. The town is basically built on this mountain where they're tunneling into the mountain for the gold. And remove the people, build them a new town, and level the mountain.
No big deal.
No big deal.
But like you say, traditionally, they had been mining gold in more of a sustainable, we'll maybe call it, for lack of another, more of a sustainable way. The mining techniques were probably a little more primitive, less technologically based, you might say?
You could call it artisanal.
Artisanal.
Or traditional. I think that when we use the word sustainable with a natural resource, it's kind of
that's why I say it with some...
Right.
But it was done in a way that was supporting the village, supported the town, without damaging the town, per se.
Right. They have been mining this way for hundreds and hundreds of years. And with the amount of gold that the Canadian company, through their studies, considers is still in the mountain, which their studies show that there's 14.4 million ounces of gold still inside this mountain.
Wow.
This could sustain this town for hundreds and hundreds of more years through this artisanal mining, the traditional practices that the miners are still using today.
Well, that was what caught my attention, is you said, oh, they've been mining this for hundreds and hundreds of years, and our mining cycle now is more of a boom and a bust.
Mm-hmm.
You would never hear about, oh, that mining operation has gone for hundreds of years. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, but it's also a very complicated story, because the way in which they mine is also very dangerous, because it is still pretty antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
They're still using dynamite. They're tunneling into this mountain. There's not great ventilation. The government is trying to force new mining regulations in terms of the way they're mining, and it's also, in a way, limiting the ability for them to continue to mine this way. The government of Colombia really is pushing large-scale mining. It's the future of mining in Colombia.
Do the local people stand to make any money from the large-scale corporate mining?
Sure. As you'll see in the film, there are, what I tried to do is really balance the story because the town in many ways in the beginning was really quite divided. There were a lot of people who were against this, immediately saying, I'm not going to leave my town. This is where I've lived for hundreds of years. Generations of my family have lived here and mined here. And then there's others who were mine owners or, workers in the mines who see this as the future of mining in Colombia and future of their town. And they're embracing that. They're embracing this idea of quote-unquote progress for them. And then there are those who are kind of in the middle, who are working in the mines. They don't have anything to sell, but they still want some kind of opportunity that this company is promising them, which would be employment, social benefits.
Right.
And so it's really a very complicated case. It's not just the victims and the people coming from the north that are there to just take everything from the locals.
How did you hear about this story? What drew you to it?
I was a photographer traveling around South America, and when I arrived in this town in Bolivia about a year into this photojournalistic trip, this town called Potosí, which is a historic silver mine in Bolivia, which basically helped to build the Spanish Empire. And I went into the mines. You could go in as a tourist, bring in coca leaves and cigarettes, and give them to the miners in exchange for photographs. And it really just struck me in a way that was, it kind of personified so many things that I was having questions about as to why was there such this stark divide in the continent, the history of colonialism, and still the echoes of that are, pervasive today in the continent. So I thought, I want to explore this theme of mining. Not only photographically is it astonishing, but also I think that it exemplifies a lot of these problems that are part of the problems that are happening in Latin America right now.
Sure. As the 21st century moves in, the traditions have to give way in some fashion.
With this idea of progress.
Right.
And what is progress? Who benefits from it? Who does not? Who suffers from this idea of progress? And what is true progress? A lot of these people use that word, sustainability, and when we're talking about natural resources, that's just, it's a contradiction.
There's a disconnect there.
Right.
You can't couple the two very readily.
So I found this town, and then I thought, I want to try to find a town where they don't have this kind of relic of colonialism, or there isn't another big corporation that has moved in and now changed that mining culture. And it took me about a year until I found Marmato. And just coincidentally, when I arrived there, around that same week, this Canadian company arrived and started buying up mines. And so I thought, wow, I've seen the end point. I would love to see what the beginning stages of what we call takeover would be.
So there's your serendipitous moment. Mm-hmm. Timing is everything sometimes in documenting a story like that.
Yeah.
Were the locals open to having you around and filming this? And same goes for the government. Were they concerned about you filming this?
The locals are really just incredible people. I really open, and within a couple of weeks, I was allowed into their homes. Just incredibly friendly people. But as the years went on and tension became higher in the town and things became more tense, I started to get a backlash. I started to get, I was being accused of being a spy for the company. I was being accused of being CIA or DEA. And also, you know, I'm sure that the company never really explicitly expressed that to me, but they were not happy with me being there filming this.
Right. So I'm sorry, then how time from beginning to end, how long did it take you to make this film?
I was filming for 5.5 years.
5.5 years?
Yeah, and the film, you know, right now we're a little over 6 years just finishing it.
And I asked the other directors who also had like 4 years and 3 years, 5.5, even longer. I mean, during the process, are you kind of changing your idea, the arc of the story? Does it shift at all as you learn more or understand more of the story? Or do you have a beginning, middle, and end? At the beginning, you stick with it.
Well, when I started, I thought I had a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And that's because when I first got there, I still had I was still driven to find the complexity in the story, and that was to talk to all sides of the people there. Who was on which side, and how can I build something that's more complex than what usually is shown? And so I went straight to the company that was there, and they told me within 2 years, we're going to have this town moved, and we're going to start, construction will already begin on the big mine. So I thought, great, in 2 years, I'll start filming, I'll find all the stories I need, and there will be this, you know, quote-unquote end, which it would be the moving of the town and
right.
that dramatic moment. And 5.5 years later, it still didn't happen. And part of the reason was that the town started to awaken. And really, those who were for the company in the beginning, there was a divide in the town, maybe by 50-50, and then it started to shift towards 90-10. And the town really started to push back, and that was because the company was making all of these promises of employment, of development. We're going to build schools, we're going to build hospitals, we're going to start doing all these things, and they never followed through. So you could see that the town was awakening to this and realizing they're not going to do what they say they're going to do.
Right.
So is this your first Sundance film?
It is.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Is it your first documentary? What's your filmmaking history?
I made a short documentary in Colombia while I was filming Marmato. You know, during 5.5 years, you have a little bit of time on your hands.
Yeah.
So I went and shot another thing that was related to mining as well.
Right.
And that was really kind of an exercise. So this is really my first film. This is my first feature, and I consider it to be my first real film.
Fantastic. It's quite a way to join Sundance.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, well, is this Sundance worthy? You ask yourself that, or do you just say, let's just submit it? I mean, thousands of other people are submitting films. Why not me?
Well, of course, we were still editing right up to the last day of the submission. And I have some friends who work in Sundance, which I met through the labs. And they were saying, look, you have to really think hard. Is this something, is it ready for this? And we were second-guessing ourselves constantly.
Really?
And then in the last week, that last week and a half, we just said, look, we have to do it. Let's just finish what we have now and submit it.
Tell us about the team working with you.
Well, it was we went through a series of editors before we really found the one that was perfect for the film. And, you know, during the course of a long production like this, I think this is kind of par for the course. You find people that you think are really going to work, and then you kind of exhaust what they can do for you, and then you find someone else that is just you really click with. And I had been working basically alone with one other producer, and then we found an editor named Ricardo Acosta, and I met him in New York. I flew back, he saw some of the material, and right after that conversation I knew for sure that he was the one that could handle the complexity of this story and really balance out the opinions and the perspectives of everyone there. And we started editing, I think, last February, really just starting the screen material with him. And by August, we had a rough cut.
How many hours of raw footage?
Close to 300.
300 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always amazed that you go, okay, I got 300, I got to get this down to 87 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that has to be a real struggle to obviously probably leave some footage on the floor.
Of course, they, you know, it's killing your babies. You have to, that, there are these scenes that you just absolutely
this
love.
This has to be in.
And you think it's definitely going to get in the film. And, you know, while I'm working during those 5.5 years, I'm also trimming things and I'm making selects and I'm thinking about what really is going to make it. And then there's other things that I'm questioning. But and then during the editing process, a lot of the things that you thought would never make it actually make their way back into the film. For some reason, it just, by way of part of this process, it naturally incorporates itself back into the film.
Plans to show this film in Marmato?
Absolutely, yeah. They have
a theater there and...
They have a small film festival.
They do.
Which is curated by a Colombian filmmaker, and he has family that is from Marmato, so they bring in a little screen and screen in the town. So we're trying to think of when is the best time. We're trying to build some buzz here, and then we'll go back to the town and show it.
Fantastic. Where can people read more about this film? Do you have a website? Or?
Yeah, the website, I think, is going to launch in the next 2 days. And we've just been written up in the LA Times, a couple different reviews, and we'll have more information online on our website in a matter of a couple days.
When does it premiere?
On Friday night at 9 p.m. at the Temple.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Super. Yeah. It's a fascinating story, and I hope it gets picked up and so that more people can see it.
I hope so, too.
On a wider... Yes, exactly. Any other plans for another film? Second film?
Of course. We're working... I'm working on a narrative, a road trip movie in Colombia, and another documentary as well.
All right.
We'll keep our eyes peeled.
Great.
Mark Grieco, he's the director of the documentary Marmato, which premieres tomorrow night. Thanks again for joining us, and lots of luck.
Thanks so much.
All right. Let's take another quick break for a couple underwriters. You're listening to the Sundance special of This Green Earth here at Whole Foods down at Kimball Junction. When we come back, we'll be talking to KPCW's Rick Ruff about his experiences with the Sundance Film Festival through the years. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
This is Alex Knapp from the law offices of Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, a longtime supporter of KPCW. Jones, Waldo has been serving clients in Summit County since 1875. We can be reached at 435-647-5975 or on the web at joneswaldo.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage services and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Recycling in Summit County is improving. The trick to remember? Recyclable materials go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and this is Chris Cherniak sitting right next to me. And we are broadcasting live today from the Whole Foods Cafe here in Kimball Junction in honor of the Whole Foods 5% Day, where 5% of the proceeds of sales are donated to KPCW for all they do in town as a nonprofit.
Thank you, Whole Foods.
That's right. So sitting here with us now is Rick Broth, KPCW's own correspondent who has years of history with the Sundance Film Festival. How long have you been covering the film festival?
How long has it been going? Well, first of all, it's unusual to have me on This Green Earth because environmentally sensitive is not the word that comes to mind. You know, when people look at it, when people see me. But,
fair enough.
Yes, but
they have other terms for you.
Right? Yes, but I have been fortunate enough to have some level of little involvement with the festival, even going back to the days when it was kind of in embryo form in Salt Lake, when it was back in the late 70s, they had two festivals down there where it was mostly a retro festival where they played old American classics and had a special program of what were called then regional films or independent films, and they gathered together a few flotsam and jetsam people from Salt Lake to judge the films every year, and I was fortunate enough to be in that group. The preliminary jury, yes. That I saw 20 or 30 pictures, and so it was a very very fortunate experience to be there. And in those days, it was informal enough that you could hang with. Today, I don't hang with celebrities, but right. Back in 78, I was able to hang a little bit with George Romero, Mr. Zombie movie.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so things have changed since then. Yes. You're no longer judging films formally. You judge them independently.
Informally, yeah. But it was kind of it was very interesting to witness the kind of synergy that went on in the early days. One of the films that first year that we did decide to put in the festival was a Texas film from a guy named Eagle Pinnell, who is now passed on. But there are some press reports that said at that first festival that Redford did see this picture called The Whole Shooting Match, and he had this kind of epiphany of that. This is pretty interesting. It would be nice if we could have some sort of an institute to help out these guys. So that was in part the spark,
right.
That led to the Sundance Institute doing the labs in the canyon to help nurture young filmmakers. And the institute to start out with for a few years was not the same thing as the festival. The festival had kind of different management, but they were there was relationships between the two entities. And then in 85, Sundance Institute took over the festival.
Right.
So have you always been covering the festival from for a radio station, a radio point of view, or were you involved in film itself in the early days?
Not as a critic, which is...
Yeah.
The filmmakers probably say that's the most useless, useless.
Somebody has to do it.
Useless role in the whole chain. But when I first came up to Park City and working for one of the two papers in town, we had the Park Record and the newspaper in those days, and I came up to work for the newspaper, and it's sort of my superstitious belief. I moved up in 80, and the festival decided to move here in January of 81. So I like to think it followed me.
Absolutely. And
they'll never admit it, though.
They will not. But
behind the scene, they probably acknowledge it.
I don't know.
How the festival's obviously changed over the years. What festivals maybe stand out to you as being kind of the high watermark of this institution?
Well, I don't know if festivals in particular stand out. Maybe there's one that kind of stands out as kind of, it stood out for me as kind of the bad luck festival because of my bad luck and things that were happening at the festival. I think 99 just didn't. There's some things going on. 99 was the year that they didn't have the Eccles Center then, so they were still trying to cram people in for very popular movies into the Holiday Village Cinemas, mm-hmm. when it was the Threeplex then. And there was a relatively notorious incident with the crowd waiting to get into the pimp documentary.
of all films.
Yes, of course. Then they get pretty gnarly. I think that was also the year that some piece of equipment at the village fell into the audience and hit somebody. It was, and my bad luck. It was the year that I said Well, the midnight show at the Egyptian, I don't know if I want to get to that one, and I missed it and I got shut out. So, and so I said, well, it's no big deal. I mean, you know, so you miss the premiere of the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, who's ever going to bother with this film anyway?
Yeah, that one. That's my famous Sundance story, the one that got away.
The one that got away.
That I was not there for.
So what are some of the strangest things that you've seen at Sundance? I mean, I think about last year when, you know, there was a camel walking down Main Street that was all over the news. I'm sure there are stories like this every few years.
Well, I usually don't see the strange things. I usually hear about them later. But
right.
Yeah, the camel, and about maybe 10 years or so ago, the naked PETA people that were protesting.
Sure.
I don't know if you recall that story.
Yeah.
That they were going kind of semi-nude on the street, and which is a real sacrifice for Park City in January.
That's commitment to a cause.
What about films then? Tell us what films have kind of stood out with you?
Memorable films. I can say that I think I wasn't at the first screening. I think it was the second screening of a picture in '92 that nobody was paying much attention to. It was this group of bank robbers called Reservoir Dogs. And afterward, this hyper kid named Tarantino came out, and it just kind of, oh, I'm bleeping excited. And just using Tarantino language that you can't repeat on the screener.
Right, inappropriate for radio.
Yes. And went to, a couple of years later, going to a what it was described as a three-hour documentary about, you know, basketball players. And so I thought, oh, wow, well, that'll be like watching paint dry.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be Hoop Dreams, which
right.
was one of the films that redefined the documentary landscape and utterly, you know, just riveting. The cliche about, you know, the three... If a three-hour movie is good, you don't notice that it's 3 hours. And that was one of those. Steve James, one of the co-directors of that, is back this year, and I think he's doing the documentary on Roger Ebert. And that's another memorable one, is the festival in '82. We occasionally see Roger Ebert, and it was one of the great festival experiences. Is that, you know, Ebert was not just a great critic, but he was wonderful as a teacher, and he had this kind of demonstration that he would take students through. He had this kind of special projector, which. In the early 80s, I guess it had kind of the capabilities that you might attribute now to a DVD, a little projector that could fast forward a picture, slow-mo, reverse, freeze, back and forth, and tape people, and he would give this lecture on the visual nuances of film, and then show Citizen Kane or something on this little special projector, and you could see things about what Wells was doing in the foreground and what special effect he was doing in this scene, even though it wasn't obviously a special effect, but
right.
It was so subtle. And we only got through about the first 20 minutes or so of Citizen Kane, and it was just an awesome experience.
That's incredible. It's like sort of the early version of some of the panels and the workshops that they do today.
Yes. Well, even in the... I think even in the first year, they did some seminars and things, but it's much more you know, elaborate now. I think they had the seminars in the Yarrow Hotel, and in that first year in '81, when it was the first year that it was a full fledged festival devoted to independent film, was the theaters were the Egyptian and the Holiday Village. And which was basically three screens then instead of four, and I think they would show some in the hotel. And of course, now we have like what, 6 to 8 venues just here,
right?
And And then we also have Salt Lake and Ogden. And, you know. So,
what are you planning to see? What are you planning to see this year?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's. I sort of go into it. I sort of willfully go into it a little blind because I just want to go see, well, what's this documentary about? And there are a couple of standouts that would be interesting to get to. The one, To Be Takei, about George Takei. And I'm just going to simply, I think the audience would probably just go to it just to see Takei show up.
Yes.
And go, oh my.
Exactly.
Yes. And the documentary about Mitt,
right.
Which is interesting because it was done by Greg Whiteley, who a few years ago had done a, I don't know if he established a Mormon connection with a documentary he did years ago about a member of the old rock group, the New York Dolls, who afterward converted to Mormonism.
Hmm.
And I don't know if he got some connection through that to let the Romneys document the thing. But it's a story about Mitt's quest for the presidency that started with a family meeting in Park City. So,
uh-huh. homegrown roots for that film.
Yes. And let's see what else we got. I'm interested in seeing the, even though I'm not a sports fan, but it's the Battered Bastards of Baseball.
Really?
Because it is about, it ties in with one of my favorite things, which is I love character actors. And it turns out that this is about a guy named Ben Russell, who played supporting roles in the 50s and 60s and hunt every TV show in the world. And but on the side, he established an independent minor league team in Portland, the Portland Mavericks. And so this was like the original Bull Durham. And and he's Ben Russell is maybe best known as the father of a guy named Kurt. Kurt Russell, who was, you remember, you know, Kurt Russell was a well-known child actor even in the 60s, even before he made it as an adult. So
right.
Interesting to see that this intersection between kind of Hollywood people and the world of baseball, and it'll be fun to see that one. And,
so,
and then I'd love to go see the midnight shows, too.
Yeah, so how many films do you see? On average.
I wish I could brag and steal Destiny Gross's numbers and do, oh, it's 30 to 45. But actually, it's if KPCW let me sleep for 2 days straight afterwards, I'd just go and try to get, you know, that 35 or 40 movies. My average, shamefully, is probably more like 15 to 25.
Still pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, Rick Bruff, one of KPCW's finest, thank you very much for coming on and sharing with us your experiences at Sundance. And,
yeah.
And we'll see you around town.
That's okay. I could have told one story, but since we're in Whole Foods, it's probably not a good setting for the tell that story.
Back
time.
In studio.
We'll tell you later.
All right. Yeah. Let's take one more break for some underwriters. We come back, it'll be time to wrap up. It's This Screen Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Alex Knapp from the law offices of Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, a longtime supporter of KPCW. Jones, Waldo has been serving clients in Summit County since 1875. We can be reached at 435-647-5975 or on the web at joneswaldo.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage services and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Recycling in Summit County is improving. The trick to remember? Recyclable materials go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up. Hey, let's thank, among other things, our underwriters.
That's
who
right.
Help support our show every week. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And, of course, Prudential Utah Real Estate.
And, of course, again, we want to thank all our guests today.
That's right.
Michael Rosato Bennett, director of Alive Inside. Todd Miller, director of Dinosaur 13. Mark Grieco, director of Marmato.
And also we'd like to thank some of the Sundance folks that joined us. Trevor Groff, the director of programming for Sundance, and Jerem Rowland, the manager of the film music program.
And, of course, Travis Harkness. He's the marketing specialist at Whole Foods. Thanks for stopping by and chatting us up about what Whole Foods is doing for their 5% day. And, again, thanks for supporting KPCW.
That's right. You can always find us on Facebook, find us online, and email us your thoughts and your comments.
And join us in a couple Tuesdays. We won't be on next Tuesday, but the 28th. We're going to have Dr. Deborah Davis on. She used to be with the National Institute of Health, epidemiologist, fascinating woman. We'll see you in a couple Tuesdays. Thanks again.
This is KPCW.
Additional funding for news and information on KPCW has been provided by University of Utah Healthcare, located at Redstone, 435-658-9200, redstone.uofuhealth.org.
Local programming all day, only in Park City, only on KPCW, 91.9 FM in Park City and the Heber Valley, 88.1 FM in Colville and Camas. This is KPCW, Park City.